Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
We made this.
Hello everyone and welcome to The Time Is Now. My name is Kurt North and Soylent Green is people. And welcome to our coverage of season 3, the final season of Millennium. And this episode is Exegesis, and that aired on the 9th of October and follows up on last week's episode, The Innocents, where we find Frank Black and Emma following up on the remote viewers, which we find out during this episode. And to join me and to talk about this episode is last week's guest, Chris Knowles. Chris, how are you doing, mate? How are things going?
Doing great. Glad to be here. Glad to be back.
Yeah, it's good. It's good to be getting onto the season 3 bandwagon now. I feel like, you know, I took a little break between at the end of season 2. You know, it was quite heavy, that those last few episodes. You know, Darren's a lovely guy, but when you're talking about the end of the world and people going insane, you know, you need a little bit of a break. So so we took a break, but we're into production of season 3 now, and I'm actually, you know, it's good. It's nice to be organized and stuff. It's nice to be able to speak to people about, you know, coming onto the show and likes of yourself from last week's, which we recorded. So that's all good. So I'm feeling back into the Millennium Zone, which is all brilliant. So we are talking about Exegesis. Now, we talked about the IMDb score last week, and it's got the same score. It got 7.2. I think we've generally talked about that episode, and because it's two-parter, we might as well just jump straight into this one. It has a different take, this episode, to the last one. Last one had a few things to work on, about introducing people, about, you know, getting the idea of mother and daughter and that kind of thing, and then we get the cliffhanger. And we do go straight into that with the, you know, where the car pulled up and the car falling over. But what's your general opinion on this episode, bearing in mind it has a slightly different abstractness to it, if that's a word, and that it, you know, takes a new direction in the show? And what would you rate it?
I probably the same that I would rate the first episode, and, you know, soft 8.
Yeah, I would go with that. I think it's it has that, as I say, the last one was kind of procedural, but because it needed to be, and this one's an interesting one, I think, and it's going to be interesting to see what your thoughts are. So it does take a bit of a turn with the kind of the grill flame and stuff. Do you want it? Should we just go straight into that? I think just with this idea of the CIA stuff that's kind of brought up in the episode.
Yeah, which is all based on fact, by the way.
Yep. I think there was 26,000 missions, and there was on 277 people from my research. I don't know if that's exactly right, but it closed down in 1995, apparently. Is that right?
Yeah, it was actually shut down by Congress. There was quite a bit of to-do about it. There was quite a bit of controversy about it, but I'd actually been to I guess you'd call it maybe a symposium or conference out in California in 2008 and 2009, and I met the guy who started that program, who I believe the Don Cody character in this episode is based on. All right. And then I also met the guy who, you know, was there at the end, who was running the program at the end. So, you know, got very interesting take on this that is a bit different than I think maybe a lot of people have.
Okay, then let's talk about that in concept of millennia then, because I mentioned last week about this idea that they have with Force Majeure in 1919 in seasons 1 and 2 of this, rather than like two owls and roosters battling against each other, or you've got the Trust, you know, they've got all these little groups that are within and without, they're all infighting, trying to, you know, get MacGuffins to survive the coming apocalypse, and then we obviously get the apocalypse. But this one goes back to those kind of feelings of Force Majeure about surviving, or 1919 about having hope, having children being the future of it. And just touching upon the Grilth Flame stuff, that, you know, that the way that Millennium is portrayed in here is that they're a threat to them, and it's all about this control thing, which was a thing in season 2, to be fair. But it's interesting how they've incorporated the grill flame, you know, remote viewing, future telling kind of aspect to it, isn't it?
It's really surprising too, because it's not something that that's something you would expect more in an X-Files episode. Yeah. And actually, you got, you know, the following year with the Sixth Extinction and Michael Crichton and everything. So it was a real, I guess, a left turn. But it always seems to me that so there's this whole controversy, is, you know, is Frank psychic or is he intuitive and everything? And I know, you know, Chris Carter had always sort of landed on the whole idea of, you know, this is just intuition and he's just a, you know, very imaginative guy. And I don't believe that at all. I think that Frank is psychic. And I think that there was probably a lot of, I don't know, maybe dissension in the ranks in the writer's room, you know what I mean? Like that, yeah. Maybe people had a different take on it. And I think that these two episodes are kind of the way to sneak that in under the door, you know, to kind of introduce the possibility that, you know, Frank is psychic or, you know, is a remote viewer himself. And, you know, like, why would he know this guy? You know, like, why would he know this Don Cody guy? Maybe he had done work for them. So I think there are a lot of implications being drawn there. And I think that's really effective in reintroducing that whole debate, I guess you would say. I mean, I don't know how many people were paying attention. I don't know how many people cared. But, you know, at least for the people who were,
I definitely paid attention to it, because it is interesting how you mentioned about the Cody thing, about he seems to know the person at SRI, that there's that to it, that at one point in the episodes he talks to Andy and says, look, I see it, you know, it hasn't happened for a long time. You know, that's almost explicitly saying, you know, his gift is back, as such, that, you know, over the 5-6 months that Catherine's died, and, you know, he's had, whether or not you view the static as him having those flashes of, I know that there was the, what Darren was saying to me during those episodes was that the static was kind of like a Darren Morgan thing at like the, you know, the not the airtime that they were getting aspect. But, you know, whether or not you view that as him having a vision of the static, of things just being static and whatever. But it's interesting how that he, after these 5 months, that he's starting to see again, and especially towards the end of this episode where she actually touches him and he does see visions of the future, and he picks that butterfly, which is one of the things I was going to bring up, you know, about this recurring butterfly theme that started off in the first episode, didn't really touch upon it, which I thought was quite nice, actually, because it's not often that we see things that are like placed in just ready for the next second episode in a lot of episodes. So it's nice that they weave that in later on. But it is, you know, it's more explicit than ever that he has, and it's almost like they're putting that in universe in general as well, that they've got this, you know, the remote viewers are there, that he's potentially part of that, that he has that ability. You know, it's really interesting how they kind of, as you say, put it under the carpet and has left the door open for, you know, Frank to have this gift. And, you know, it's changed in so many ways with the, you know, things like.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
Chumba. That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay. Oh, what's the episode? Second season. Single Blade of Grass, for example. The visions he has there, compared to what he has in season one, and then season three, obviously, then, you know, he has this kind of remote viewing experience, and it's just another play on that, but it seems to be more focused on the entire episode more than just, you know, just a glimpse it's more explicit as it ever has been.
Well, I think that this is part of the effort to, you know, it seems to me like a soft reboot almost.
Yeah.
And you have your whole new cast and all the storylines are kind of changed around. So, and again, I mean, you know, what you want to do with a pilot or a soft reboot pilot within a series is just make sure that you're setting up the basic plot points that will be developed over the season. You know, I think that if you watch the X-Files pilot and even the Millennium pilot, I mean, I think both pilots are just so perfect at setting up the universe that you're going to be working within, right? And I think that I know that, you know, Morgan and Wong had kind of wanted to do, and I guess maybe someone would argue that they did, you know, a soft reboot themselves, but they were following on a cliffhanger and a continuing storyline. And I must say that God, did I hate that Brian Rodecker character. There are very few characters that I just absolutely despise in 10-13 shows, but boy, did I and it's funny that they just sort of got rid of him halfway through the season because, like, oh, this isn't working. Yeah, and it's a shame because I think that guy who played him is a good actor, but that character was just so badly written. But when you get to the so there are a couple things going on here. So I think a lot of this is Johansson, because I don't know how much investment Duggan had in this. He might have been more of like a nuts and bolts kind of Bob Goodwin kind of guy. I think a lot of this was coming from Johansson. Well, obviously, because he wrote this episode, right? But, you know, like the butterfly symbolism, that's like, I don't know how deep you want to get into that, because that's, you know, you can get really lost with, again, with a lot of the internet conspiracy stuff, or, you know, sort of Samizdat underground conspiracy stuff, because there was this whole thing with this Project Monarch, which is like this mind control program that allegedly grew out of MKUltra, but the remote viewing programs actually did grow out of MKUltra. So there's a direct lineage there. You know, you never really have that explanation, like what are those butterflies actually doing, like why are they there. I think that smacks to me of Johansson, who I think is just kind of, you know, putting down a marker just in case he tries to get into the, like, the whole monarch symbolism later on in the season. But I think what they're really doing, And I think they did really well, because I think that they did a great job at setting up the new world that we're going to be operating in. And I think that this episode was, you know, getting a little deeper, like, how crazy is this stuff going to get? And again, this whole association with remote viewing and the apocalypse, you know, that to me feels very Carter-esque, because that's something that, you know, we'd seen before and we'd see after in the X-Files, right? You know, with Gibson Praise and everything like that. And then later with Mulder in The Sixth Extinction and Amor Fati. So that to me feels like a Carter injection, so to speak. So I think there are a lot of different people's, you know, this broth has a lot of different cooks, but I think it came together really well. But again, I mean, this is a very grown up Millennium, you know, I mean, like this, season one of the Millennium is very, you know, it's like death metal, you know, it's a Marilyn Manson album played out on television, right? And I think it's interesting that you had even the same kind of graphics. I mean, if you look at the kind of graphics that you saw with Millennium as far as the credits and some of the promotional materials, and then those lead-ins with the quotes from the Bible passages and stuff. None of that would seem out of place on like a Nine Inch Nails or Marilyn Manson album, and I think that's kind of the aesthetic that they were playing into. But I'm not sure.
They even had Nine Inch Nails on the pilot episode, didn't they? So
did they have Nine Inch Nails? Oh, he did. They had Pig, right? And they also had More Human Than Human, you know, White Zombie.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's pretty clear that Carter was Carter. It's interesting too because he's very influenced by music, and you know, kind of alternative music too as well. I mean, those big bass drums, you know, with the what is it called when they come back from a commercial break? I'm blanking out on the name of that phrase there, but you know, when you come back from the commercial break and be like bum bum, right? You know what I mean? That's sampled from a song called When Mama Was Moth. You know, there's your kind of butterfly symbolism again from this Cocteau Twins album called Head Over Heels. I mean, it's those drums are like if you go to anybody who wants to hear like those big Millennium drums, just look up When Mama Was Moth on YouTube. And, you know, there it is right there. It's kind of funny. They just sampled it. I mean, they would change the pitch and stuff, but it's a direct sample of those drums. So Carter, you know, is very much drawing on that kind of mentality and that, you know, at that time, very marginal alternative kind of worldview that I think informs a lot of Millennium. But I think that, again, it's like the first season is just too dark. It's too heavy. It's too uncompromising. It's too unrelenting. And I think they kind of went a little too far in the other direction with some of the season two episodes. And then season three is like, it's kind of like it's trying to recapture that equilibrium. You know, it's not trying to dismiss the things that, you know, a lot of the positive changes that were made in season two, but it's trying to, you know, integrate them with the aesthetic that the show first started out on. So it's a tough balancing act, but I think that it's interesting to me, you know, getting back to the whole issue with the butterflies and the psychics and all that kind of stuff, it almost seems like that's the third option. That's the third road. That's door number three they chose to take in this effort to try and, you know, reintegrate these two extraordinarily different seasons of television together.
Yeah, I mean, they do it. I mentioned in the first episode about the eyes as well. The eyes seems to be a recurring theme that they obviously have put in place, and that resonates more through the season than unfortunately the butterflies do. But as you say, it's interesting that they have put that in there. So the Millennium Group obviously appear more in here as well, because Mabius makes his first appearance, and we get the appearance of Peter Watts as well, and Frank's reaction to Peter when he's at the school is an interesting one in itself. And I think it plays off really well, because the thing about, we mentioned this last episode, I think it was yourself that mentioned this, about the way that Peter's portrayed in this season that people have strong opinions about. But in this particular scene, if we're just looking at this particular scene, there's nothing in this that actually implies Peter any difference to what Peter is. Now, Peter obviously disappeared at the end of The Time Is Now, you know, because he was going to see Lara, and obviously he disappears at that point. So we don't know what's happened between then and now. But there is this, you know, the fact that Frank is going all out. He's literally, you know, he's a loose cannon at this point. And Peter is actually saying, "You're not listening to me," kind of thing. And he is trying to talk to him, and just Frank's not letting him. And I think that's a brilliant reintroduction of the pairing, because they bounce off each other so well. But I do like the way that they've brought him in here, because it's like Peter's actually the calm, cool, collected, "I want to talk" one. And it's only when you get to the maybe a scene where he's in the car that there's anything.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Being kind of off-kilter with it. It's just really interestingly played.
Yeah, well, again, it's also like the point of view storytelling. So, like, you kind of get the feeling that this is all through Frank's eyes. And he would naturally be very soured on the group at this point, right? I think that he would have good reason to be. And, you know, I think that, you know, when you say that Peter now sees him as a loose cannon, I think that's very apt, you know? I mean, that happens all the time. And I think this you know, I think one of the problems, again, is that people, you know, particularly people online and online fandom have like very peculiar in-universe types of expectations of how characters are supposed to act. And it draws on, I don't think it draws on the same, you know, the same kind of material that a Millennium or an X-Files would be trying to draw on. You know, like, you can't expect everything to be like Warehouse 13 or Supernatural or something where there's this very clubby, fanny, conny kind of way that the characters interact with each other. I mean, what 1013 is trying to do is trying to place this in the context of how things happen in the real world. And when, you know, somebody's wife dies a horrible death because of this engineered virus, I mean, that's going to change the way people think about other people. Yeah. I mean, you know, what are they supposed to do?
Yeah.
And, but, you know, it's interesting too, because I know that even Lance Henriksen was, you know, he didn't know what was going on as far as how he should be relating to Peter and whatnot. I mean, I think Terry O'Quinn understood, and I think he played it beautifully. But, you know, the thing is that the way television is done, you don't get like a full script, right? You know, you don't get so you can't sit there and look at the, you know, you get pages like bits at a time, you know, and you've got to play particular scenes without knowing the overall context of the story. And this is something, you know, I was just reading some interviews with people, you know, involved in the X-Files. And, you know, it was just really amazing to me that, like, people like, you know, Bob Goodwin, Rob Bowman, you know, Kim Manners would be making these episodes and not have any idea what the hell was going on, and wouldn't have any idea what was going on until the show was cut, you know, until the show was edited. So I think that that's, you know, maybe something that should have been communicated a little bit more effectively to Lance, but maybe, you know, him not knowing, it adds that extra bit of friction, you know?
Yeah. Cause it kind of informs the character, because he, the way that we're seeing, as you say, seeing through Frank's eyes, he's lost his wife. He's having to bring up a child on his own, and the people that he now believes was involved. And he's already had this, you know, this balance between, if we look at it, as you say, more from a point of view of a human experience rather than just what TV would do around that time. You know, X-Files was just as guilty sometimes as anything else. You'd have the episode, the next episode, nothing would really matter with what happened beforehand. You know, you get obviously slight adjustments in things like the Pine Bluff variant, where he's in Folie à Deux, he's still got the, you know, the finger tape and things like that, some continuity that way. But from a, you know, a growth, the growth of Mulder and Scully was a very, very long, drawn out process. You know, and Star Trek would be the same. You know, you'd have a 45-minute episode, someone would be really kind of affected during that episode because of something that was done to them, but next week they'll be back as normal. So there's like a reset thing going on. But the way that this is portrayed is that, you know, we don't, you can't really accept or expect you know, us to know whether or not the Millennium Group was involved. It could have been written completely different in that, you know, that the Millennium Group are being blamed, but they aren't the real, antagonists in the series as such. Obviously, you know, that's slightly different to what actually happens, but it kind of goes back to something that's mentioned in this episode, actually, about the way that Baldwin talks about the women, and that the casket's being found in the basement, that it is believed that they are responsible for the outbreak that happened last spring is what's said. But then it's actually Frank who says, you know, they're not the terrorists. Terrorists is being rained on them. And there's intricacies like that, which I think 1013 do really well. It's, and, you know, the fact that it's very explicitly leveled at Millennium at that point, it's like, well, are they going down that path? You know, as we see it now, without the foresight of what we know for the rest of the season. But at this moment in time, if you're watching this fresh, you don't really know that. And, you know, some people will take it immediately as like, oh, they're the bad guys already. But I don't think it plays that way here. I think that Frank is hurt that he's going through kind of a grieving process, and that Peter is the sounding board, and he's the one that's been blamed for what has happened in the time is now. And it's just a really interesting development on that, from that point of view. And as you say, I think Terry O'Quinn does a fantastic job, as does Lance Henriksen, the way that is portrayed, and as a first like coming together, I think it really does work.
Yeah, it does. And it's the kind of thing that again, you're setting up, you know, the bowling pins, right?
Yeah.
For later on in the season. And I think that those kind of, you know, I think there's a lot of care here. I think that at one point, Ken Horton had said that, you know, he'd come back, I guess they'd come back from maybe the Christmas break or something like that. And, you know, he met with Chip and they said, like, do you have any ideas? And it's like, no, I don't have any ideas either. You know, like, they were just kind of exhausted at mid-season. But I don't think that, you know, what you see on screen reflects that. And I think a lot of that has to do with, I think that there was a lot of care to set up this new world that the characters, and when you do that, when you set that up, you know, really carefully, it's always like once it comes time to start writing scripts, which is always going to be a torturous process, that, you know, half the job is already done. You know, like one of the things I say about Millennium and also about the X-Files is that so many of these episodes operate like a feature film. And, you know, even though they're only 43 minutes long or however long, look at how a feature film is going to take how long, at least 20 minutes world building, right? It's going to take 20 minutes at least to set up the kind of universe that the characters are operating within. So I think, you know, in that regard, that it you really get, you know, you get all, like, it's like, what did Hitchcock say? Was it Hitchcock? Is like, you know, a film is like real life with only, you know, with all the boring parts cut out. Was that Hitchcock? Yeah. So, you know, the stories, you know, a good solid 1013 episode, you know, which means not any Harsh Realm episodes, because Harsh Realm was trash. I just want to always get my Harsh Realm digs in there. And I just, you know, it just really bothers me that, you know, a lot of the, I think Millennium could have found its feet with another season. And I think that it was kind of sacrificed at the altar of Harsh Realm, which is just hot trash. Really, it just makes me resent the show all the more. I think that, you know, no network is going to give a series three seasons to find its feet, right?
You know,
it's just not going to happen. But yeah, I think most shows
are finding the feet by the third season, aren't they? You know, if you take a Star Trek, for example, Next Generation was probably getting better at season three. You know, so yeah, so I think, you know, if you haven't found your feet by the third season, then I think it's, you know, it's difficult. And even in these times, you wouldn't get that long. So it's interesting from that point of view.
Oh, well, on a network, you wouldn't even get three episodes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you don't hit the ball out of the park, you know, first time of bat, you're screwed. So again, you have a lot of interesting things going on that, you know, are underappreciated for a number of different reasons. You know, one of which is I think people just lost interest in the series. Second of all was the controversies over season two, you know, that people took very sort of extreme stances on one way or the other. And I think that that hurt, I think that hurt 10-13 in general, you know, like that there was just this cleavage within the fan community, but also, you know, a cleavage between, and I'm, you know, not cleavage like most people use that term, but, you know, this sort of break between Carter and Morgan and Wong that took a long, these rifts that took a long time to repair. There was a lot of bad feeling, you know, I think mostly between Glenn Morgan and Chris Carter. And I think one of the problems is that, you know, they're just too much alike, you know. It's, you know how like some people, when they're just too similar, they don't get along together.
Yeah. I mean,
it's just like, yeah, this. It's almost like same ends of a magnet or something. I think that I think in a lot of ways that, you know, there was just a lot of butting ahead because they're almost like brothers, I think, in a way. But so that hurt the show. So again, I mean, we're looking at a season that, you know, is generally forgotten, is not generally highly regarded, even among a lot of fans of the show. But again, I mean, being somebody who came in old, you know, as much older than most of the people watching the show at the time, I mean, it was in my mid-30s by the time I actually watched this entire season and this entire second season. Well, actually, the entire series, because I don't think I'd seen like more than a handful of each season before, you know, I dived into the boxes. But being older and being more aware of the, you know, particularly in this season, the thematic material and the source material that they're drawing on, it just blew me. I just can't believe like just how hardcore they went on this, because I'll tell you something. You would not see this kind of stuff on television these days. It would just be seen like, no, forget it. You know what I mean? You're not going there. Because some of the stuff they get into this season is really dark, it's really heavy, and it's really real. I mean, it's, you know, an episode like Collateral Damage, I mean, that's based on things that really happened, you know?
Yeah.
So they were using, you know, Gene Roddenberry had always said, you know, the great thing about science fiction is that you can talk about current events and current politics and everything and have that sort of distancing mechanism of science fiction. Just, you know, if anybody calls you out on it, just say, hey man, it's only sci-fi. It's, you know, a kiddie show, relax, you know, don't worry about it. I don't know if you really had that kind of excuse in this show, because it's so down and dirty and gritty and as real as possible as you can make it. And they're drawing on some really, you know, talking about a lot of things that people got killed for trying to publish about. So it's pretty grim.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about it. I think Frank Spotnitz has said this a few times about the, you know, we need to base the fantastic in the in reality. You know, look at like the 731 abductees that, you know, using the cancer arc, for example, or, you know, and basing it in reality. You mentioned that last week, touched upon it last week anyway. That what I find quite interesting in this episode in particular is that the women who are protecting the mother are, you know, they do, apart from obviously the eyes being so brightly blue that they are, they do seem mundane, normal people, and they go about the throughout the episode, you know, trying to evade the Millennium Group, which I personally have a bit of an issue with within this episode. I think it could have been left more, what's the word? It could have been, it could have had, you didn't need to be as pointed as to it being the Millennium Group as being the bad guy. It could have just been that something was going on, that there's this party. Could it be the Millennium Group or not? That's the way I would have more enjoyed it a little bit more. But we get very pointed to parts of the show, especially in the final act, where you've got, you know, someone going, you know, we're part of the Millennium Group, and, you know, we're ex-FBI, and it keeps pushing that. And I know we'll get into, Matryoshka, later on in the season?
Matryoshka?
Matryoshka. You know, I know that they'll touch upon it at that point when we get there in the season, that, you know, that's why they're pushing the FBI kind of aspect. But they could have kept that more,
at arm's length and just had this mysterious people that are after the women. But what I like about the women is that they're using the easy move, and it's very coy move that they do. That, you know, the fact that on the plane was brought down. Yes, it's a very kind of terrorist act. It was brought down to hide the fact of the people who were surviving, because they thought obviously the, you know, the people would have died on there and they weren't even on the plane. Or with the easy move van as well, the fact that, you know, that one of the women sacrificed herself with that roadblock because she gets ended up getting shot at, and it's a decoy because the other two have managed to get away. And I like that. I like it's not going all out there and being, you know, a fantastic adventure. That they are down to earth, and it's rooted in reality. And, you know, the Millennium Group are kind of after them, but it's only when you get to the third act that it becomes a bit more fantastical, especially with Frank getting crushed by a lift, which I don't know about you, but I find really comical. But yeah, so it's just really interesting how they kind of, you know, ground it in reality with regards to them.
I think you're right. And I think the weakest part of this episode is that third act. And that's something, you know, the abandoned missile silo. I mean, we saw that in Apocrypha.
Yeah.
And I think it was Joss Whedon who sort of made this veiled dig at the X-Files. And he was talking about, like, you know, it always ends up in like an abandoned warehouse or something, you know. It's funny because, like, when you begin to really think about it, it's like, oh,
yeah,
and it does. I mean, right up to the last episode, right?
Yeah.
So, the very last episode. So, you, I think there are a couple things going on there. You've got to have, when you're setting up all these major plot points, it's got to be resolved in a big, flashy way. You know, you can't just. You can't just resolve it like in the way it would be resolved in perhaps a real world setting, right? So you've got to have like that kind of splashy 10-13 big finish. But you know, there's also some interesting information there, and it almost seems like there's like some sort of psychic link, you know, between. It's like a mind meld, right? You know, with the visions of the apocalypse and the nuclear war and so on. You know, I think that is kind of. It almost seems to me that that's the goal. You know, is to sort of set up this mind meld. You know, this connection. And again, there's also the psychic subtext that Johannesson certainly is clearly trying to reintroduce to the show. So, there are a lot of, you know, kind of stock gunfights and, you know, that's the whole scene with Frank and so on. I mean, you know, you got to have those kind of things, because that's almost like, if you didn't, people would just say, well, that was really boring. You know, you've got to have some sort of excitement. You've got to have some sort of grand finale, so to speak. Because that's just, those are the conventions of genre television, right? You know, this isn't some, you know, true crime Netflix program. You know, this isn't Mindhunter, which, you know, it's interesting how many comparisons you can draw between Mindhunter and Millennium. You know, I mean, Millennium, for a show that was so, is so largely forgotten today, I think it's very fair to say that it's pretty much forgotten.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Gotten by the general public. It's just amazing how many shows it's influenced. I mean, the entire CSI franchise, right?
Yeah.
And you know, certainly Mindhunter, I think, is.
Yeah, and Hannibal.
Hannibal. Well. Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah. So there are a lot of people drinking from this well. Even if the general public doesn't really appreciate it. And you know, those are often the kind of things that I gravitate towards, you know, because I've watched so many you know, I'm in my mid 50s now, and I've seen a lot of movies, like more than most people have ever seen in their lives. Watch a lot of television, and I'll tell you, I am just sick to death of it all. I don't know if I've told this story on this podcast, but I think about maybe 20 years ago. So I was working on like screenplays, and there was some interest from people in the film industry and some of the stuff I was writing. And I was trying to do like the whole Quentin Tarantino method of like, you know, just film school via VHS rentals. Right, yeah. And I got this like unlimited, and I think that the people in the video store dreaded every time I walked in, because I got one of these unlimited memberships that most people don't even like use, right? They sign up for it and then never use it. But I was like going in, buying, renting like 5 or 6 movies every, you know, a shot and watching them. And by the time I was done, I was just like, I hate this. I hate these movies. I hate Hollywood. I hate the way these stories are told. It's everything. They hit the same beats. They hit the same rhythms. It's kind of like, it, you know, reminds me of like a blues thing, you know, where it's like, well, a lot of people love the blues, but you know, it just, I realize that it's everything has the same underlying structure, you know, everything is like 12 bar, 1-4-5, pentatonic, you know, everything is following the same core elements, and it just gets exhausting after a while.
It does. I remember going to see Gary Moore, and you know, as much as I enjoy music, I enjoy going to see bands and things, and after about, I'd say, 30 minutes, I was like, I need to check out and go somewhere else for 5 minutes, because you know, blues in itself is as you say, it's that way. So it's yeah, it is interesting how you know, you can get, you know, as much as I would love to like spend the 2 hours there, I just physically couldn't do it. So yeah, that's just my thing on blues anyway.
Yeah, and he's you know, such a great guitarist, and he's so great than Lizzie. But it just gets to be exhausting. I had the same experience. I had gone to see the Pogues when Joe Strummer was touring with them as singer. And it was one song for 90 minutes. You know, they play it faster and they play it slower, but it was like one song. It's like, you know, like the kind of like jig and reel kind of thing. Yeah. And it just gets exhausting. So that's the way I feel in general about movies and TV today. It's just like, I'm just exhausted, because you just realize that it's all the same. And the things that I really love and the things that I really get excited about, you know, are just like these weirdo visionaries, like, you know, Twin Peaks, The Return, I just thought was just absolute godhead. And, you know, as far as movies go, I don't know if you've seen Mandy, the movie Mandy.
I haven't seen Mandy, no.
Oh, you've got to see Mandy. It's absolutely brilliant. And it's funny, too, because I think there are a lot of like millennium. I don't know if there's a conscious influence there, but if you're a fan of Millennium, you're going to see a lot of parallels or like, just like little bits, like little hints, little riffs, little bits of flavor that will be very familiar to you. But it's just so completely bug nut crazy that it's the top and it's total. But I love that, because I want to be surprised, right?
Yeah,
you know, one of the things with like television, and it's, I think it's the same thing with comedy. So things, you know, get played out, you know, and we're at a point in time right now where, like, you know, when I was growing up, people were interested in like older movies, people were interested in older TV shows, older music. And now that's all just been discarded, because, you know, everything has just worked its way through the body politic, and people are just sick to death of it. You know, people don't need to see it anymore. And I think, you know, there's X-Files, which has fallen on the good side of the fence there, and there's Millennium that's fallen on the bad side of the fence. And I think that's really unfair, because I think that Millennium has, you know, I think it's more relevant today than it's ever been, right? Mm. And I also think that it was just so far ahead of its time. And maybe that's the problem. Maybe it was just too far ahead of its time. Maybe these two episodes in some ways were too far ahead of its time. Maybe a lot of the third season was just too far ahead of its time. It was telling stories that people didn't want to hear yet, right? And maybe today people would want to hear those stories.
Well, that's something that Darren and I talked about last season as well, about how it seems to be so, you know, of its time, but at the same time, you know, if you placed it in a modern day scenario, it probably would work. You know, maybe obviously a slight retooling, but then you would lose some of its, you know, magic as well. But it is an interesting issue that, you know, as much as like genre TV is now, and the fact that it's all literally pre-planned in advance, that you've, and you don't have the issues that we would have at the beginning of this season, at the beginning of season three, that you have to talk themselves out the corner like we discussed last week, or, you know, you'd have time frames, like you say, with the Kiss episode that we talked about, that, you know, that was put on them. You wouldn't necessarily have those issues. It'd be more condensed and stuff like that, or likes of, you know, things that's happened in the X-Files with Gillian Anderson getting pregnant and how that changed the landscape of X-Files. So there's all that kind of thing, which might not necessarily happen as much in modern day TV, but then, you know, some of the stuff that's been mentioned within this episode and the show as a whole, that, as you say, you know, put it into a modern day situation, it wouldn't that be far that far removed, really. A couple of things with Frank, I think. So we talked about Frank. We talked about how he, you know, how he's still not quite there with the Peter aspect. But there's also these few issues that he has with Andy. He talks about, you know, the fact that, you know, Andy's saying he's not ready, and then Frank almost has like a crisis of confidence at some point. It actually takes Emma, which is another reason why I wanted to bring Emma up as well, is that, you know, Emma Hollis puts in so much, you know, pulls Frank out of it in some ways, because he's ready to say, you know, you're better off staying away from me, for example. And she's the one that pursues it, and sees the, as I mentioned last week, the terrier of the thing. It's like, no, well, there's something about this woman, Frank. You need to come out and see. You need to be able to do this or whatever. But in this episode, she seems to be the one that gets him back into the field. And I think that's a really interesting and, you know, it kind of like feels like, you know, it's an intricate part of the show, which people don't really give it too much credit for. But Frank is going through stuff here, and I think that, you know, it's almost like a rebuilding of his story, really, because he's literally hit the rock bottom as of last season, and you have to start somewhere, and he has to start from the beginning and work his way up. And Emma's the conduit for that.
Well, that's again, I mean, I just love that character. You know, I just thought it was really, it almost seems to me like, so, you know, you have like a potion, right? And you need that sort of that one ingredient that's going to be the catalyst for all the other ingredients. You know what I'm talking about? Mm, you know, yeah. In chemistry or whatever. And I think that, you know, I don't want to put too much on her character and put too much on her shoulders, but it just seems to me that that was the missing element. Not just, you know, her character itself, but her viewpoint. You know, the way she, you know, interacts with Frank and the way she relates to him, it almost feels to me that she's, you know, I don't want to oversell this, but it almost seems to me that she's like our representative, you know, like she's... Yeah. She's representing the viewpoint of the audience watching the show, particularly people who are still on board at this point in time. You know, even though, like, you know, you said the numbers, like in 1998 setting, they seem to have cratered. But today, you know, any network showrunner would kill for them.
Yeah.
But, you know, she gives us, we're able to enter this very strange and unpleasant world through her, the person who has no idea what's going, you know, or maybe has like an inkling of what's going on, but has no idea just how bad this can all get. You know, that offers, you know, she's like the bridge for us, right?
Yeah, she is. Yeah, but yeah, she is the bridge, and I think it's probably a good way of describing it, because as you say, it's like it's the way that she's or what I said before, that she's pulling Frank out of this. There's otherwise, where would he go? Maybe the FBI would be the ones that would get him out of the hole, but it just would. I don't think it would work that way. So I think that Emma is vital for that reason, as you say. It's you know, and it's our way in to Frank. I mean, in the past, obviously, with Frank, the way that he was and how stoic he is and how you know, confident he is. But at this moment in time, he's not. He's at his low ebb. So, yeah, so that in itself is good. What do you think to then this idea of the way that Millennium is kind of asking the question about the missile silo, for example, at the end where it's actually explicitly said that the men who built this place, you know, they control the world all within their fingers, but there's no enemies, there's no wars to take place now, and you know, they seem to be lost, because that seems to be the way that they're going. That it's not, you know, the way that season two was portrayed is that, you know, you've got this upcoming apocalypse, and whoever, there's sides that can win, whether that be a religious analogy or secular one or whatever. But in this one, again, it seems to be like there's no, it's more of an allegory to the world, because of the fact that at this point in time, you know, September 11th hasn't happened. The war on terror isn't around at the moment. There is the militia stuff. There is things like the Oklahoma bombing and things like that. But there's, you know, there's, we're in a really interesting period for Millennium around the 97, 96, 97, 98 mark. And they're kind of referencing that at this point, saying there's no enemies at the moment.
Well, it's a fool's paradise, really, right? I mean, it's just like this little oasis in history. And this is why I'm saying that I think the show is more relevant today than before.
Yeah.
You know, maybe not so much with like the serial killer aspect, because it's I think it's a lot harder to be a serial killer today with like surveillance cameras everywhere and so on, and smartphones, and you know, nobody's going to break down in the middle of the highway and not be able to call somebody anymore, right? You're kind of hobbled in that regard. But I think that you know, overall, and really, I think the direction they should have gone in earlier. You know, I think that it's more, it just feels more relevant today than it did back then, which is really ironic too, you know, it's because it's like most shows exist of their time. You know, one of the things that, you know, they always say about the X-Files is that it was, you know, capture the zeitgeist. I mean, I think that the X, in a lot of regards too, the X-Files is, you know, so many things going on in the headlines today were, you know, prefigured in X-Files storylines, plot lines.
Yeah.
But I think that the Millennium, I just think that the general gist of it and the flavor of it is, again, I mean, it was just ahead of its time. And there were a lot of things going on in the 90s that were ahead of their time. You know, a lot of things that were underappreciated, or, you know, maybe appreciated only by a small group, that, you know, are built for the future. And I think that the, you know, particularly this season, is that way. I think a lot of people, if a lot of people go back and watch these episodes in light of like the things that have happened in the intervening 20 years and the things that are going on now and the things that are going on in the news. I mean, if you go back and watch this, particularly the season, but the entire series on a whole, it's going to give you a much different understanding. You know, it's going to change, you know, it fits more with the things that are going on. And this is the problem with people who have their ears low to the ground, right? A lot of times when you have your ears low to the ground and you're really tuned into the rumblings in the distance and the things that are going on in the margins of society, you just get that far ahead of the curve. And I think, you know, with this season, that these, you know, whoever is involved in plotting out the season and the storylines, you know, I think a lot of it's Johannesson, but I think a lot of it's Carter too, because I know the things that he was reading. You know, I know that a lot of things that he said that he had been reading in interviews and so on, you know, show up, like those themes show up in this season. But, you know, they were, you know, they're still going on, and maybe, you know, the more prominent in the news and in people's consciousness now, because 20 years ago, listen, I'm like, again, I'm old, right? I'm in my mid 50s, right? 20 years is nothing. And if you're able to sort of step back and ignore all the hype and the nonsense that, you know, the tech industry and all these kind of salesmen are trying to push at you, things aren't that much different. You know, like cell phone technology is definitely better today, right? But, you know, you talked about social media. We had social media. AOL, you know, Facebook and Twitter are really just AOL, you know, developed.
Yeah.
You know, when I look at Facebook, I'm just like, how is this not AOL, right? You know, I remember being on AOL in the early 90s, and it's not – how is it any different? You know, oh, okay, it's faster, and you can put more video up and all this kind of nonsense. But it's all basically the same thing. It's not any different, you know, from dial-up AOL. It's not. Yeah. And I really – it drives me crazy because it's just like people sort of parrot these things like pretending that this has been this great march of progress since the mid-90s, and there hasn't been. It's just not. I mean, I always see like the mid-90s is when things just stopped. I think like everything just kind of stopped. And, you know, we had incremental improvements. But what can you point to that's going on in the world today that wasn't going on when this series aired? Like name one thing, like one major thing that was not prefigured or in development when this series ended. I can't name anything. It still feels the same to me. When I place myself back in that world, you know, I just remember things were better, you know, and people were generally happier, and things, the economy was better and all this kind of stuff. But nothing has changed. And it really, it drives me crazy when people say that it has, because it hasn't. You know, we're not flying around on rocket packs, you know, we're not living in giant glass domes underneath the ocean, and we're not, you know, flying to the lunar cities and all this kind of nonsense that, you know, science, like I really start to see science fiction, and this is a huge tangent, this is a huge sidebar, but I think it needs to be said. Like, I think science fiction is a negative, corrosive force in our culture, because it gives people completely unrealistic and completely unfounded expectations of how the world should be and how the world is. It's just, it's all fantasy. You know, there's no difference between, you know, even what they call hard science fiction and Lord of the Rings. There just isn't, you know? I mean, we're not, you know, we don't have cities on Mars, you know, we're not flying to other star systems. That is so far down the line. Because of just the reality of like physics, you know, just basic physics preclude that. Never mind economy of scale and so on and so forth. So what I'm trying to get at here is that there's no reason to not watch all of Millennium, you know, except for the like 13 years later, right? Or, you know, some of the really crap episodes, you know, like, I don't know, Wide Open, you can skip, whatever. But this is, there's no reason to not look at it and go, this is...
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
More relevant today than ever. And the world has not changed.
Yeah.
Substance.
It's a progression, isn't it? Rather than an actual like physical full-on change. It's just
it's
a progression.
It's not even a progression. It's not. It's just incremental. It's not a progression. It isn't. It's just incremental kind of cosmetic changes is the only difference between 2020 and 1998. Because believe me, I was alive back then. I was, let's see, 1998, I was 32 years old. I had two kids, right?
Yeah.
I certainly was making a lot more money back then. But, you know, things... they just weren't different. They weren't, you know, they just weren't. I mean, it just drives me crazy that people think that we've had some great march of progress, and there hasn't been. I think in a lot of ways we've had regress, you know, because I think that video games and smartphones and social media have really damaged our neurology. It's like damaged our attention spans. It's damaged, you know, people have much, you know, mental illness is much more prone now. But, you know, all these things you can see the seeds of in Millennium. And that's why it's like people really need to go back. And because I would almost argue that in some ways it's a very hard show to love. It's almost an impossible show to love. And it's a very hard show to watch. Right. Yeah. But if you really want to understand what's going on today and how we got here, watching Millennium is as good a place as anything that I can think of on network television to go. It really is. It's as good a place to go if you really want to see the seeds. And again, it's like people, you know, people like Chris Carter and Chip Johannesson, who really had their ears very low to the ground and were really in tune with the things that were welling up in the margins and the weird corners of technology and culture and politics and, you know, fringe, so on and so forth. You got to see it here. And it's like, when people just dismiss season three, did you watch any of the other episodes? Like, why do you do that? Because, you know, you were influenced by, like, being in high school and being influenced by people were saying on, I don't know, Alt TV or whatever, Alt TV Millennium. I don't even remember because I was just so.
Yeah, because there was Alt TV X-Files. I don't remember. I remember vaguely looking at Alt TV X-Files. I don't remember if there was an Alt TV Millennium. Must have been. I don't personally remember that. But
Alt TV X-Files was it?
Alt TV X-Files. I remember
dumpster.
That. Yeah.
It was just trash fire. It really was. I mean, I would scan it, but you know, you see these threads, and you know, it's one of the things that happened. By the time I would say by this point in time, I seem to remember that Alt TV X-Files was just sort of dominated by like a small handful of people who, if you did not agree with them, they would dogpile you.
Yeah.
And drive people out. And I have to say, one of the things that really hurt the X-Files as a phenomenon and as a phenomenon within fandom was just how incredibly toxic fandom got. Because by the time of like season 7, season 8, the fandom was just poisonous, and so many people who would, you know, I really like that episode of the X-Files. I think I'll go online and see if anybody's talking about it. And they would just be sandblasted by just pure venom and vitriol and just said, oh, screw this, you know? And one of the things I mentioned this in other, I think on the X-Cast, but like, Vince Gilligan, you know, Mr. Southern gentleman, soft-spoken, polite Vince Gilligan gets absolutely livid, gets apoplectic when he talks about how the fandom treated Rob Patrick and Annabeth Gish. It makes him very, very angry. And I think that was kind of written into the series towards the end there. But, you know, at this point in time, I don't think that people even cared enough about Millennium to argue. And I think that's a real shame. I really do, because there was so much interesting material. I mean, you know, just going down the line here. Let's see. Sound of Snow, which we've talked about, the whole thing with subliminals and electronics and stuff, Collateral Damage. I'm sort of going back and forth here.
Yeah, Sun Dreamer and Mercury.
Yeah, Darwin's Eye.
Yeah.
And you know, particularly, I hope that you're going to have me on to talk about the last two episodes, because I just think they were phenomenal. And I think it's just so brilliant the way that they, you know, tied it together. Like, I think, like, you know, I said, like Jim Morgan tried to do with Fauna's Mutation, because, you know, people go, well, what's this serial kill of the week and how do they justify this and everything like that? And the thing that Horton and Johannesson said that I just thought was just so brilliant and just so, you know, just vicious was like, well, there's all these serial killers out there because the Millennium Group is programming them so they can justify their own power, right? And I just thought that was absolutely, you know, we can get to that later. But again, this is just a series that people need to watch. And you know, if you're a fan of the series and you're a fan of the X-Files and you're just like a conscious human being who's aware of what's going on in the world around you, I think this is television that you really need to rediscover. I really do.
Right. Well, I think that draws it perfectly to a close. And unless you've got anything else for this episode, I can confirm that you are scheduled to be on the final two episodes of the season. So we'll have great fun talking about that. But with regards to this episode, is there anything else you wanted to just touch upon, or should we call that a day and catch you later in the season?
The one thing I do find interesting is there's a weird connection between these episodes and Minority Report. Claire Scott is in Minority Report. I don't know if you knew that. She plays a very small role. But the woman who plays one of the daughters is in Minority Report. You know, fairly small role, but when they break into the building where Tom Cruise is hiding in the bathtub, she's the mother who starts screaming at the kids. I'm trying to think who else. There are some people in this episode, like, just that were in there.
Strangely enough, Minority Report is actually within arm's reach of me on my DVD collection, so it's literally to my left.
Yeah, I really like that movie. And talk about, you know, prophetic, right? Talk about a movie that has legs and seems more relevant today. I mean, you know, just go to Google News and just type in Minority Report, and you're going to see hundreds of stories from the past few months, because it's something that people are constantly talking about. Yeah. But, you know, there are people who – this is a weird 10-13 thing, because, like, Neil McDonough, who is in a couple nine-season episodes, is, you know, one of the main characters in that. And Patrick Kilpatrick, who is in an eighth-season episode, is in that. Just, you know, that's kind of things that I just – I'm fascinated by, like, just like these two totally separate franchises, really, that have all this crossover with various characters. The woman by the name is Katie Boyer, is the actress who's in both.
Okay, so if we look at social media, Adam Chamberlain has been on just to welcome back, Adam. We're looking forward to seeing you on the show. He just put, I just rewatched this two-parter and I gained more and more respect for it with each viewing. It doesn't get a lot of love, but I'm sure that more about how it plays off when we left things in the time is now. It's an intriguing story, which is often unexpected turns, and I think it is to be applauded for that. Engage or re-engage with it on its own terms. And there's much more to commend it. So if you hadn't seen, here's a question for you then. Do you think coming into this as a new viewer without really knowing about everything in season two, do you think that that would be, or trying to like forget everything that happened in the first two seasons, that it stands up on its own, these two episodes?
Oh, I do. And I think if you cut these two episodes together, it'd make a great movie. Like, you know, you remember how like in the 80s and 90s, you'd have these like movies based on like John Grisham books or something, like, or I don't know, you know, just this kind of thriller writers. You'd have like a movie with like, I don't know, Jeff Bridges and Meryl Streep or something, you know, like just the general's daughter, just any kind of like Ken Follett or just whoever, just various kind of, just stories that weren't blockbusters, but just really good thrillers. I think this would stand up pretty well if this was just released as like a thriller in and of itself. I think it'd stand up. And I think that it does such a great job of reintroducing the characters that you wouldn't be reliant on that. And I think that if you had somebody who were like, I want to check out this Millennium thing, or, you know, what's that about? You know, this wouldn't be a bad place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. And on Twitter as well, we've got some feedback on Twitter. So at Oscar Grouchos says, time has been kind to this two-parter. So again, it's kind of coming back to that, what you said before about revisiting this and re-engaging. So that's both Oscar Groucho and Adam have both said that, you know, both like looking at this again, which is really good. The retooling of Marburg as a victim of media hyperbole through the prism of an anxiety-ridden age is especially timely given this year's developments. Deftly written introduction of Emma Hollis, the best part of the third season. And I've just, Russ Hugo also jumped on that as well and said, I'll first echo support for Oscar Gratcho's points. Emma Hollis is one of the top aspects of season three, and her introduction is done quite well. To a much colder, including more blue and grey tones, distant and stark feeling. In that sense, the production deftly matches the mental state of Frank. Going forward, it also helps ground some of the more surreal episodes. Like season three as a whole, there are some strange and poor choices, but it's got a lot more to appreciate than it's generally given credit for, at least once we get past episode five. Stephen E. Miller's portrayal of Andy McCarron never really clicked for me. He's a good actor, but I don't think he had the right chemistry with Henriksen. Barry Baldwin's introduction is a bit too campy, i.e. let's make sure people know he's the AJ Rimmer of season three. That's a Red Dwarf mention. But not bad. And Peter Outerbridge does a really good job with the material he's given. Overall, the clone storyline doesn't work for me that well and feels too much like X-Files. However, I really enjoy the production style change. So what about the production style change and the actual kind of photography and the kind of filters and stuff that they use within this? Because there is that element as well, isn't there? There is a definite change in the stylistic approach to the show as well.
I liked it a lot. It had like a real aura about it. Very atmospheric. And I think it really sold the stories, even when the stories were weaker. It reminds me of the cinematography in season 11 of The X-Files, that even when the storylines weren't really up to snuff, it felt like vintage X-Files, but different. You know, it was sort of the best of both worlds. And it's a real shame that the event series, season 10, Joel Ransom's a very good cinematographer, but I think that there was just too many balls that needed to be juggled. You know, they were shooting in summer and, you know, there was just too many problems with that. But it does remind me of that. It just has this kind of, I don't want to say like fairy tale aura, but it just feels like you're entering like a different world that looks like ours, but it's almost like a parallel reality. So I think that's a very, that's a good comment.
Yeah, it's a very, very astute comment there. I think, I would agree with that. And I think the episode plays into that as well, which is really good. So yeah, so that's the social media for this episode. So keep them coming, guys. It's much appreciated. Okay, then. Well, Chris, you will be back. You're going to, I think you're coming back for Skull and Bones, actually. So we'll see you
in a treat.
Yeah, exactly. So we're hoping to arrange that with yourself and John Kenneth Muir. So that'll be good to talk about that. We've got various returning guests as well. Just before we finish off on the second week, we've got people like Adam Chamberlain coming back. Darren will be talking with us, Chris, on The Sound of Snow as well. So we're looking forward to that as well. We've got David S. Walker back, hopefully. Tony will be here for potentially as well. I'm not quite sure. Yes, I think he'll be doing he's been doing the Lucy Butler episode. So we have him coming back. So, yeah, so a lot to look forward to in season three. And as you've alluded to, it's definitely worth rewatching for those people who are sticking with us with the journey. Some people will be, rewatching again along with us, and it'd be interesting to go through this season and at a time and going through it and critically analysing it, and also seeing how it resonates in today. So it's all fantastic. So where can people find you online then? Before we go,
secretsun.blogspot.com and the Secret Sun Speaks on Twitter.
Okay, fantastic. And you can find me at R. Muldrake on Twitter. That's R-M-U-L-D-R-A-K-E. Find me on the Star Trek Picard podcast as well. Make it so at Jean-Luc Podard, as well as the X-Cast, which I know Chris mentioned before. That's the X_cast. And the Red Dwarf Shipwrecked and Comatose podcast, which you can find on Twitter at Red Dwarf Pod. So thank you very much for joining us. And until next time, remember, this is who we are.
Elsewhere, and We Made This. The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast.
There's just this moment, and I can see it in my head now, of complete glee that Scully has on her face as they dive in to open their presents. And it's you know, the camera's moving away from the scene. It's not even like a huge close-up, but just her choice in that moment as an actor is just superb to give us that sense about what their dynamic is. Mm-hmm. I love the... I said it earlier, I love the kind of almost holding fingers moment at the end of Field Trip is beautiful.
Right in the childhood.
Mark, you heard the bell. We better get back to the podcast.
Really?
Yeah. I thought, you know, keep with the theme.
Keep with the theme.
Keep with the theme. Recess, you know, school stuff. Did you know, I didn't talk about this before. So, you know, like in primary school and in high school, in all kinds of school, you have a break, you have a 15-minute break, then you have a lunch.
Yeah.
I feel like I was the only kid in my schools to ever call that first break recess.
That's because you're not American.
But, like, what else do you call it? Break.
Break. Break and lunch.
I've decided after rewatching this that my breaks now in work are going to be called recess.
Mine are not going to be called recess.
Cerebral jukebox.
I thought that Stevie Nicks was a boy and that Lindsay Buckingham was the girl who was singing on it. So, because I just assumed by their names that was the way around it went. And then when somebody else told me I looked like Stevie Nicks, I was like, thanks, I guess. I guess I'll grow my hair.
How dare you?
Yeah, it was Big Burly Man.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This podcast network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod or on the website WeMadeThisPod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.